let them leave the earth for 21 days. No problem. You know, without any additional anything else hooked up to it. And it'll be able to go a million miles out, no problem. You know, why couldn't they take this thing with a, you know, an attached module and go out to the James Webb telescope to repair it if they had to? You know, you're not locked into the 600-mile limit that the space shuttle had. You know, if these spacecraft are going to be capable of going out to the asteroids, well, that's what, 1.6 AU, you know, it's past Mars. I mean, if they're going to have that capability, it should be no trouble to go to the space telescope and repair it, or even into a geosynchronous orbit with these spacecraft that they're going to be developing. You know, so that's what I'd like to see there.
To get into geosynchronous orbit, or the Lagrange point number 2, I think it is, it takes an awful lot of energy. It's the energy limitation that allowed you not to go above 600 miles on the space shuttle. So to take any amount of hardware out there to do a repair, I don't think that's easy. When you wind up a gyro on the Hubble Space Telescope in order to steer it to a new direction, do they use a reaction control jet to unwind that gyro, if you happen to know? WS2N, K2RAW.
I know the Hubble didn't have any kind of jets. They didn't want any exhaust, let's call it exhaust. They didn't want anything to contaminate the lens. So as far as I know, they were all momentum type of gyros, and then they had magnets. Works good for low Earth orbit. They have magnetometers, where they magnets that tend to help them. Some kind of a deal like that. Fine tuning it. I don't know. As far as jets, no, they didn't have anything like that on the Hubble. And they probably wouldn't have it on this thing. You know, they have it on the International Space Station. The jets all over that. They actually do have fuel on board. They probably could. I didn't hear anything designed for that. Once it's in a stable orbit, you know, and they have it set, they'll probably be okay. It's got this gigantic sunshade. I mean, huge sunshade that's going to cover this whole thing. And that's like, looks like the size of a bus when you look on it. You know, compared to the size of a man, you know, it's 40 or 50 foot sunshade that, I don't know, maybe even bigger than that. I'm not sure how they're going to stabilize this thing, Dick.
Ionic motion does not contaminate the lens. I wonder if they have it.
Yeah, I've been asked by a few people, if we used an ionic engine, could that possibly keep the lens clean but still give you some thrust? What do you think, Paul?
Oh, yeah. I think that would work good. Yeah, they've had that. They've actually brought that up to the space station, tested it on that. But, just as test equipment before the Dawn launch. And it was also used on a previous mission, as a test mission. The previous one was, what was it? I think that was the one, they eventually changed the name to the Shoemaker. I think what was it called? It had landed on Eros. I can't think of the name of that. But I mean, after it landed, they made the name Shoemaker, you know, for the guy that discovered all these comets. I'll think of the name in a minute. But yeah, that had an ion engine on it. And then this one here had three ion engines on it. on. They don't fire at the same time, it's one at a time. But I mean, they're clean. Yeah, I don't see any reason why you couldn't use that. Although I think if they had that, I would have read that when I did all the reading about the James Webb. So, probably don't have that on board. You need to power them things too. And big solar panel for it. So, we'll see. I'll look into it, Dick. Back to you.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Sounds like fun. And let's hope that James Webb does go, because Hubble, I guess, what's our best guess? Hubble is good for, what, about 3 or 4 more years, and then things will start breaking down, and there's no more repair mission capable. I don't think any of the other craft are capable of bringing astronauts to the Hubble for repair mission. So I should know, what's the approximate estimated life that Hubble's got left to? And at the end of that life, what do we do with it, Mel? Paul, WS2N, KQRIW.
They're going to let that go until it quits, one by one. As things break, whatever's working, they'll keep going. They completely changed out the solar panels at one point. They've changed out all of the big batteries, gigantic freaking batteries. Each one is like 30 inches long. It changed out all of the, I think, maybe all of the gyros of the time. The computers on board, which is equivalent to a 486 computer. Remember them? That's what's on board. They changed that out. I think eventually a Pentium replaced the last one, if I'm not mistaken. What else? Not to mention all the lenses and all the electronics involved with that. They had a power board failure. They had to change out 30-some-odd screws. So pick one of the ones that are going to be catastrophic, and that will end the mission when we drop it.
And I think they also put some kind of a fixture on the bottom of it, which allows them to attach a thruster at some later time. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, you read my mind. I was just going to tell you about the contraption that they attach to the bottom of it. So you could send a spacecraft up there without people, attach it to the bottom of the spacecraft, and, with grapples, throw bottom, and then deorbit this thing. I mean, that'd be the fate of the Hubble. Eventually, we'll be landing in the Pacific Ocean as a big meteor burn up over the North Pacific. So, that's the ultimate plan. So if they can run this another 5 years, they'll do it. And if the gyros start to fail to the point where it becomes out of control, they don't want that to happen. They want this thing to be still stable, otherwise they'll never be able to attach a spacecraft to it to deorbit it. So they don't want that to happen. Once it starts spinning, they lose control. That means no spacecraft, no deorbit, and you'll have a Skylab with, pick a spot. Hope it's not over my house. Back to you.
That's going to be exciting. I hope we still have Lou, NY2H. I know that you had a question from earlier, Lou. Sorry we kept you waiting so long. NY2H, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, hi, Dick. No, actually, I did not have a question. I was just going to comment on the link situations. And basically tonight, for a little while there, we went on an EchoLink conference rather than our IRLP conference, just to get the thing keep it up. But that was it. That was all. So carry on, and we'll talk to you soon. NY2H.
So bring us up to date now, Lou. Normally we have IRLP plus EchoLink, is what I think is going on. And tonight we only have EchoLink. The IRLP is not working, or is now everything back to normal? And what is that normal? Back to you, Lou.
All righty, very good. We're back to normal. We're on IRLP. Thank you to Eric. He recognized it was a DNS problem, and he fixed that. In fact, when he fixed it, that's when you were getting all that feedback a while back, because both systems were up simultaneously, and so you had Echolink in conference, and you had IRLP. So then he brought down the Echolink, and things were fine. So it worked. Actually, it works a little bit better. It doesn't drop out as much as RLP does. So there you go. That's it, but we're back to normal now. Back to you.
While we're at it, Lou, if we make the mistake of timing the machine out, does that time out the IRLP or Echolink in such a way that they have to be reset? In other words, do we have to be super careful to make sure that we wait for all four beeps to make sure that we don't lose the IRLP connection? Back to you, Lou.
Affirmative, because, for example, before when, I'm out east here, I'm in Medford tonight, and I can't hear Glen Oaks, but I can hear Selden. And I guess before when John jumped in and said, don't forget you had NY2H out there, I didn't know if you called me or not, because as soon as he said that, the link had dropped. But in answer to your question, it does auto reset, so it should not require any intervention. It should come back in a couple of minutes when it does that. But I don't know, if you want to listen to both, I know you can do that. You'll be aware of when it drops out or not. But I know you have enough on your hands already. So this should all go away. You may be getting an RF link, so this issue should go away.
Joe recognized. One more question, Lou, and that is, when the RF link is established, will we have a system where some of these dropouts don't happen, many of these time delays don't happen? My guess is life will be a lot simpler when it comes to the linking of the two repeaters when the RF link is operational. Is that true, Lou? Go ahead.
Hopefully, yes. It depends on who you speak with. Andy's working on it, and in theory, the answer is yes. The delay should go away, and the associated dropout problem should go away. I think Derek and some others might be concerned about the link frequency, so we don't know. So it's going to be empirical. But best case, yeah, that should all go away.
Go right ahead, Eric, and then we'll pick up Joe in that order. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. When the RF link happens, you're still going to have the same issues. We want to maintain the connection to the outside world. You're still going to have the delays associated with Echolink. And you're still going to have the timeout issue with IRLP. You just won't have it with Selden, that's all.
Okay. Joe, to B2LYY, go ahead.
Okay, we're good, Dick. I was trying to pay attention during the space report. Was it mentioned, maybe I missed it, that they found a new moon around Pluto, and it was discovered by the Hubble spacecraft. The new moon is apparently only 20 miles in diameter at a distance of 3 billion miles out.
I heard that, Dick. Yeah, I think it's the fourth moon of Pluto. They were doing a real hard search for a ring around Pluto. I don't think they found the ring, but they found the fourth moon. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's what they were looking for, but yeah, they found a, they call it T4, this. I didn't give it a name yet. The other ones are what? Nick, Hydra, and of course Charon, or some people call it Charon. But that one, very teeny tiny. And they're very happy that they could resolve this thing with the Hubble. Only imagine 20 miles out, and the thing was it 39 AU, something like that. But, wow! Thank you.
For those who are really interested in astronomy, and astrophysics in general, you do want to get a hold of the August issue of Scientific American. August issue has on page 38 a very nice article entitled, Does the Multiverse Really Exist? There's more and more evidence suggesting that what we call the universe, we think that's everything. It's not everything. Just think about how many levels and how many times we've been humbled. In the very beginning, we were positive the Earth was the center of everything and all the stars went around us. Center. The sun is the center of our solar system. And the sun is just a good-sized star midway between downtown and the suburb of this particular galaxy. And we thought the galaxy was everything. Well, we're part of a galactic group. And we thought the galactic group is everything. Well, it's part of a universe. So, let's see now. Planet, sun, galaxy, galactic group, universe. We're in our fifth level of step and repeat of humbling. We're not the center of anything. And now we want to think that what we call the observable universe is everything. There's probably a lot of evidence that, and the dark energy, in my opinion, is one of the pieces of evidence that, that there really are multiple universes and multiple Big Bangs. You'd like to think that the Big Bang is the only one that ever was, and that's the one that we're inside of. Let me drop. And that's rather unlikely. Why should we be favored that way? We're not that special, if you know what I mean. So, and now, when it comes to multiverses, there's multiple ways you can do that. Is our universe and the other multiverses around it just another bubble? And now there's multiple bubbles? You can step and repeat this as far as you want. Very, very difficult to figure out that this universe appears to be empty space that goes on forever. Very difficult to wrap your mind around that, that the empty space goes forever. Everyone wants to believe there's got to be an end somewhere. I'm convinced there cannot be an end. You've probably heard me say many times. If there was an end, if there's a wall out there that's the end, well, it's time to go out there and drill a hole in that wall and find out what's beyond it. So there really can't be an end. And the article says that although the Big Bang was 13.4 or 13.7 billion years ago, the observable universe is 42 billion light years. That's our observable universe. And the Hubble Deep Field Experiment, where you aimed Hubble into a dark direction in the sky, where there wasn't much dust, but it was dark, and you integrate for 1 million seconds, and what do you see? 2,300 galaxies you've never seen before, with great big redshifts you've never seen before. Much, much more distant objects. So as I see it, let me drop. What you call the observable universe is a function of how big is your telescope, how precisely did you aim it, and how long did you integrate that picture? How long did you use the light bucket to gather photons and make a picture out of it? You use bigger and bigger telescopes, longer and longer integration times, and higher accuracy of aiming, and you're going to see further and further. Because out at the absolute limit of distance on the Hubble Ultra Deep Field photograph, a pessimistic person would say, well, the number of stars and galaxies out there is getting smaller and smaller. It is not. There's no apparent decrease, as I remember our reading day analysis. So our current observable universe is limited by our current equipment. And so James Webb, when it becomes operational, guarantee we're going to see further, find more things, and you haven't heard the end of the story. You got to think big. I believe we've gone through everybody who signed in who had a question. Let me double check and see if that's true. Anybody sign in that I missed you? Give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And a correction, 5WS2N.
Call recognized, but let's see if there's anyone that I missed.
WGBT.
Okay, we're going to go to him. Paul, go ahead with your correction first.
Yeah, the first ion engine was on Deep Space One about 10 years or so ago. And that's the one that had the one engine, not the Near spacecraft. The Near spacecraft is the one that they eventually changed the name to Shoemaker. The
That was the one that had a single ion engine, went to a Haswell Comet or something, Comet Braille, but went to another one too. But more sophisticated one is the one that, that's now in orbit around the asteroid. So there you go. That's the deal. So we've used them really three times in space. One time as a test on the space station, one for Deep Space One, and now for Dawn. Back to you.
Cassidy is due to be sent off of Earth. Did I hear you say this coming November, Paul? Go ahead.
Okay, it's Doug. November instead of August. That's been delayed, which gives us an August 2012 landing date.
Okay, Paul. I mean, Doug. W-A-2-S-A-Y. Go right ahead.
W-A-2-S-A-Y here. You mentioned that the you can see forever if you have a big enough telescope. I don't think that's really true. You say the universe is something like 13 billion years old. So anything that's over 13 billion light years away, you're never going to be able to see. Back to that.
Not true. Now, that's exactly what I used to believe until I got this latest issue of Scientific American. August issue, page 38, Scientific American, 2011. They say the observable universe is 42 billion light years. We can see out 42 billion light years. But the stuff that we see there, the rate at which it's traveling, and the distance that each of those particles, the so-called Hubble constant, strongly indicates that the Big Bang of that material occurred 13 and a fraction billion years ago. But we can look out considerably beyond where that material has spread to so far, is my understanding. So that article says observable is 42 billion light years. Maybe that's what John's going to correct us on. And also John has a question. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I don't know about correcting, but yes, we can see past the point where our Big Bang happened, but the universe is much larger than that, and if you follow the membrane theory, you will realize that they're getting close. Between string theory and the membrane theory, we have many membrane properties that's out there. When they touch, that's a Big Bang, and it's happened many times, and I'm sure that the observable universe, even if it closes on itself, is much larger than that. So, like you say, that's what we can see as we develop our acuity. We're going to get further and further out there, no question about it.
Yeah, I was really surprised by that 42 billion light years for the observable universe. And I guess that's implying a radius of 42 billion light years in all directions. And that assumption, I'm wondering, is that Hubble limited, if you know what I mean? Or some of the ground-based telescopes are considerably larger than Hubble. When you get a place like Paranel, the beautiful mountaintop in northern Chile, where the European Southern Observatory, the USO, ESO, has some very substantial hardware, interferometry-type optical telescopes. So stuff on the ground with optical adaptation of the lens of the main mirror are doing some awfully good work. That best piece of work I know of, which was announced a couple of years ago, was that they were able to observe Halley's Comet at the maximum distance from the sun. Halley's Comet is blacker than a piece of coal, and it's out there at some ridiculous distance, and they were able to pick that out from the background at the, I think it was magnitude 28 or magnitude 29. Really dim. So, you had a question, John, KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, I had something you might have information on this for me. It has to do with aircraft weapons. Air-to-ground, I'm interested in the laser that paints the target. and the asset that receives the information, the weapon itself. Is that laser pulsed in a specific pulse train proprietary to the receiving asset weapon, or is it just looking at a blurb of light? It's hard for me to believe that works. Do you have any information on that at all? Maybe you can explain.
I haven't directly worked on one of those weapons, but I've gathered some information indirectly, and I've got some speculation. The laser designator is what you're talking about. In other words, the pilot on the aircraft, he decides that that's the target, and he aims a laser in that direction at that target, and now the target is illuminated. And whether or not it's illuminated with infrared, ultraviolet, what wavelength is illuminated is part of the equation. How it's modulated is part of the equation. The seeker that's on the front end of the missile that's going to that designated location, it's got an as-el gimbal thing in the nose of that missile, and it's seeking that particular wavelength, seeking that particular modulation, and when it goes there, it's going to explode when it hits something, or in some cases explode before it hits the thing to give you the right cone of destruction, so to speak, so the shrapnel spreads out just right. In the case of a surface-to-air missile, you want to explode it before it gets to the airplane in many cases, so that you get this the spread of material that's moving at a very high velocity up toward the aircraft, but it has a distribution in azimuth and elevation that covers the aircraft and puts a lot of holes in it. You don't want to put all of your energy in one spot. You'd like to make a lot of holes in the airplane to make sure that you disabled it. That's my understanding of what's going on here. So I am of the opinion that it probably has a very specific modulation, and that modulation might be the code of the day, in which case the countermeasures to that, or the countermeasures to that, becomes much more difficult. Those are speculations on my part, but I can see good reason for doing that. And it's not too difficult to do.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Could Kate Eguiber comment on this?
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, some years ago I knew a friend in engineering that was with a company that specializes in things of this sort. You know, as they say, better ways of killing human beings. And I had questioned him about, you know, surface-to-air missiles. And he said, the only thing I will tell you, yes, the laser is an integral part, but the correction system actually is exhaust. They are actually using exhaust from the aircraft as the correction for in other words, possibility at that time of using methods to deter the missile from hitting. In other words, it was locking on to, yes, first the aircraft and then correcting itself by now looking for the exhaust. Go ahead.
Yeah, when it comes to the infrared-seeking type of surface-to-air missiles, the hottest signature probably is the exhaust, and that's an easy thing to go for. But what John is talking about now is air-to-ground with a laser designator. I don't think they've often used laser designators on ground-to-air, but there I'm not sure. But to be able to choose the target and make sure that the missile precisely hits that target, that laser designated system is a kind of a crafty way to go. And in many cases, the predictions by way of the NOVA program, I think I've seen recently, or is it Need to Know, one of these we're moving in the direction of remotely piloted vehicles. And as such, the warfare in the future are going to be machines attacking machines, and the human being is far away controlling the things that are doing the attacking. You got to remove the human being from the equation, because killing people is unfriendly. Killing pieces of electronics and mechanics is a lot friendlier. was a comment I was going to make along those lines. Oh, yes. I am still amazed when I see any of the documentaries about the weapons that we used during the Civil War. 620,000 people died directly in that war. And a hell of a lot of casualties way beyond those numbers. I mean, of the 30 or 31 wars the United States has fought, 30 of those wars just barely add up to the rate of death of just that one war, Civil War. That is a huge number by my standards. And you hear the description of what took place at Gettysburg or Antietam. Wow. I mean, just sitting there in lines of troops firing at each other, and the grief that that creates is just out of sight. So the most killing that has ever taken place of our people is in the war when we fought ourselves. There's an awful lot of questions to be answered there as to how in the world we let that happen. I wonder if you, is that the only question you had right now, John? KC2WGB, KC2RIW on the TechNet?
I think you've answered my question, Dick, but on the air-to-ground asset, if we had two aircraft that were pursuing two different targets in close proximity, I was wondering how the device differentiated between this is my kill, that's your kill. That's why I was asking you that specific question.
Yeah, you think it was being done a coded message by way of specificity. I think the coded message, if it's there, is in order to make it more difficult to create a countermeasure. I mean, a countermeasure is that somebody could decide that, gee, I don't want to be the target, I'm going to shine a laser over here and let it go for that particular target. Well, if that laser doesn't have the right illumination, the right wavelength, and the right modulation, the weapon doesn't go there, is my guess. But I'm having trouble believing that you're going to have that many simultaneous targets that closely spaced. When you're starting to use this kind of weaponry, you're going against a very high-value target. These are not cheap weapons. I think each one of these launches is a good fraction of a megabuck. So are there going to be that many high-value targets in one particular location where you've got to launch weapons against that many simultaneously? I'm guessing that's a very rare event, John. Let's see. I think we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. I think we've addressed each of the people who signed in with questions earlier. Let me double-check to make sure that's true. Give me your call letters and name right now if we've missed you. K2RIW in the tech net.
Final comment, Dick, before I go, K2KUYW.
Go ahead, Mel. And I hope your batteries for your portable radio have been holding up for you these days. Give us a couple of words on that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, you're phenomenal. I never seen cells like this. I don't know what they are, but they're phenomenal. This is, like I say, cells that are building. They're building batteries. They were building, I don't know if they're still in existence, but this company was building their own batteries for their electric cars. And boy, oh boy, these batteries are effective for their weight and size and all. I am really impressed. But I was just going to say that if you notice lately, in the last couple of years, they were able to take out certain people, terrorists, with robotic, you know, aircraft that they actually were flying up from Virginia, from Channel 13 did that program on it, where the guy actually sits there in his room. And he's looking at screens, and he's flying these things, these robotic aircraft. And they took out people, and he goes home at night to dinner there in Virginia. But how did he? It actually did facial recognition as to who they were taking out. Dick, over.
Wow, you're fairly sure that the remotely piloted vehicle, and I think they're really being piloted from a location in the Southwest. I don't think it's in Virginia, although maybe there's more than one location. You believe that the remotely piloted vehicle did facial recognition before designating that particular person as a target? And that one I hadn't heard. Back to you, Mel.
Actually, in fact, it was definitely from Virginia because It was from Langley Field, Virginia, I believe they said that, you know, with everything was classified, but you saw him sit in front of the screen, and he, you know, they showed the gentleman, and he goes home at night and had a dinner with his family. And they were showing that. They locked on, and here's this person of, I guess, whoever it was, a terrorist of some sort, getting into this car, and they just didn't blow up some car out of nowhere. They actually targeted this thing, and that's according to watching it on Channel 13. They took the car and him out right away, Dick, by recognizing him from whatever hell adult the suit it was. I just don't understand how, where, but they were able to do it, Dick. Over.
Pretty fancy. You got an opinion as to how soon we should leave Afghanistan? Got an opinion on that one, Mel?
I think anybody does. I'm afraid we're going to be there for a number of years. I don't know how you're going to resolve this because you're dealing, you know, I'm more worried about, you know, domestic terrorism. If anything is on our minds after what happened yesterday in Norway, this is really, to me, very scary.
E-J.
Yeah, that Norway incident, that was a reasonably neutral country. Go ahead, Eric.
I just want to let you know, in the mid-80s, the computer graphics lab at New York had one of the things that we did. We created some images and some events. And let's put it this way. Was flipping a bit. It's not a big... In the 80s, we could resolve, say, crisis. You could read them very well. So that's K2RWK, again.
By whatever, you had nice clean audio, Eric, but your audio was dropping out periodically as you talked. You might want to know about that on that particular conversation. So at New York Institute of Technology, you guys are doing recognition, I guess, optical recognition and facial recognition in particular. Is that what you were saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I did. We were using big machines then, but now, you know, with the machines that we have, you can get yourself a program that says speech recognition, talking type, technology, done.
I think these computers are going to catch on. I think cell phones are going to catch on. 305 million cell phones in use in the United States right now. 5 billion cell phones in use in the world right now. That's a lot of cell phones. And it is my belief that the majority of that development of that product took place at Murray Hill Bell Laboratories, roughly 1970, and one of the leading people doing it was Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, Whiskey 2 Charlie Quebec Hotel, a guy who used to be on 432, and I used to talk to him very frequently way back in the late 60s, early 70s. And when I met him face-to-face around 1970, he was describing this cellular telephone concept and the fact that he had already visited Japan to find out who was going to start manufacturing the hardware to actually carry it out. Who would have known that such a idea then would develop so prolifically? Right now, there are a number of countries where if you take the total population, men, women, and children, the number of cell phones is 10, 20, and 30% greater than the total population. Wow. This RF and wireless, I think, is here to stay. Let me drop. Okay, I received a significant list from Wesley on when it comes to the deeper subjects we discussed tonight. And I think the list is a little on the lengthy side. I'm not going to get to too many of them. I know that he wants to differentiate ferrimagnetism from ferromagnetism, which is one of the subjects. And I know when it comes to basic measurements, volts, amps, ohms, impedance, network analyzers, oscilloscopes, and so on, I know that the Wesley desires greater communication there. If you take a quick look at the Ferri magnetism, F-E-R-R-I magnetism, you Google that word, and you go to the Wikipedia index for that one, Wikipedia website. It does a medium good job, not a great job, of explaining what Ferri magnetism is, and somewhat differentiates from ferromagnetism. Let me drop. This is not one of my areas of strength. But when I went to that website, I got the impression that the majority of the magnetism is coming from spin of the electron, not the orbital motion of the electron, the spin of the electron. And the Pauli exclusion principle usually says that if there's only two electrons in a particular orbit, they must have opposite spins. So therefore, the materials that have the greatest amount of magnetism, the suggestion is they've got incomplete orbits. They've got an odd number of electrons in some of the orbits in order to have spin accumulation, in order to get magnetic field accumulation. But ferri magnetism materials are the materials where, for reasons I don't quite understand, you get the positive magnetic field and the negative magnetic field forming in a natural manner in that material. And for reasons that's not clear to me, one of those magnetic fields happens to be stronger than the other. That's why there's a residual magnetic field that you send. It doesn't get cancellation. However, the ferri magnetic materials have this peculiar characteristic with reference to the Curie temperature. Let me drop. Almost all magnetic materials, if you heat them up with a torch and you exceed the Curie temperature, a specific number of degrees centigrade, where you exceed that number of degrees centigrade, essentially all magnetism disappears. But in the case of the ferri magnetic materials, there is sort of a range of temperatures over which the magnetism is dying. And in the case of ferri magnetic materials, where you've got these two magnetic fields in opposite directions, somewhat fighting each other, one of them starts being affected by the high temperature before the other one. So you get a peculiar kind of cancellation earlier, even though there's still some magnetic field in the plus and minus magnetic field present. So you get two temperatures of Curie-like effects in ferri magnetic materials. The ferromagnetic materials also are the exotic ones, like the yeet material, the yttrium iron garnet, which has this very fancy resonance phenomenon, precession, magnetic precession resonance, that allows you to make some extremely high-Q, electronically tunable filters. I've got quite a number of years of use under my belt of yeet-tuned oscillators and yeet-tuned filters, so I got a gut feel for the way they work. And they give you a lot of extremely precise tunability. Yig materials, and some of the ferrite materials are also ferrite magnetic. The ferromagnetic materials have a simpler kind of magnetization. That's what little I know. I bet you've delved into it quite a bit deeper, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. Well, I was trying at first to justify the difference between these two. And ferri, I believe I pronounced it properly. I didn't hear anybody referring to that material anywhere. Ferri, magnetic, is when the moment of the aligned anti and anti-aligned ions balance completely, so as to have a zero net magnetization. And despite the magnetic ordering, then it is an anti-ferromagnet. orbit alignment effects only occur at the temperature below a certain critical, so that is being called Curie temperature. But there is another temperature that is being called a new temperature. I wonder if I pronounced it properly.
Not sure how it's pronounced, but the word magnetism, my goodness, is that a subject and a half. There are materials that are called ferrimagnetic. There are materials that are called ferromagnetic. There are diamagnetism materials, paramagnetism materials, anti-ferromagnetism materials, superparamagnetism materials, electromagnetic materials.
Wow.
And it looks to me like one of the really major forces in the universe seems to be magnetic. I'm getting the impression that magnetism is what really kicks that radio wave off of our antennas. I'm led to believe that the electrostatic effects are a very minor effect by comparison, that the magnetic effects are what's really launching the signal. I'm seeing a lot of evidence and I'm coming to that conclusion. And what goes on at the atomic level of an atom or a molecule, magnetism is non-important. At very close range, yes, electrostatic effects are also extremely important. But when it comes to the, what's the word I'm looking for now? Macroscopic. At the macroscopic scale of our antennas, way beyond microscopic, I think magnetic is dominating. When it comes to the radiation phenomenon, when it comes to what creates, let me drop this. What's creating the current flow in the metallic usually metallic conductors of our antenna, the electrostatic effects, the what's the word I'm looking for now? Joules? Nope. Joules, that's energy. Coulomb. The coulombs of charge flowing back and forth in our antenna is the mechanism that creates the current. The current creates the magnetic field. The magnetic field starts the radiation. That's the way I'm looking at it. And you try to come up with mathematics that explains that signal jumping off your antenna and going into space, and you try to explain that purely electrostatically without the magnetism, it becomes much more difficult, particularly when you view the fact that, when you accept the fact that essentially not a single electron leaves the antenna. Lots of magnetic field leaves the antenna. And that wave gets propagated into space. And it's got an E component and an H component. But the E component is not made up out of electrons. It's not made up out of charged particles. The E component seems to be there because of the rate of change of magnetic field creating what you sense as an E component. Let me turn it back to you, Wes. But I think we should jump fairly rapidly into the instrumentation that does measurements and why we care so much about those measurements. N2XJN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. In particular, the material is ferromagnetic only if the magnetic ions edge positive contribution to the net magnetization. So, in some of the magnetic ions subtract from the net magnetization, they are partially aligned or anti-aligned, and then we're dealing with the ferrite magnetic material. So, any kind of unevenness in the domain sleep where they are just remain in the chaotic stage, it's a certain region. It's ferrite magnetic. As far as the new temperature and justification between new temperature and Curie temperature, Curie temperature is the temperature at which the magnetic material becomes anti-magnetic material. That means it loses the domain alignment. But the Mr. Neal was living close to 100 years, and he was born in 1904 and died in 2000. He's got the Nobel Prize in 70 from physics, working on this area. So the TN is the symbol from the Neal temperature, and the temperature is about which the anti-ferromagnetic material becomes paramagnetic material. Now, I stated similar for the Curie temperature. Well, the Neal temperature is analogous to the Curie temperature for the ferromagnetic material. It is. But there is certain justification of the Neal temperature in the certain area. So, practically, it looks like we have almost the same factors. Back to you.
Is the major reason for your interest in magnetic properties and magnetic materials, is it because of the rotary machines and their capabilities that you were studying about a year ago, Wes? Is that your main reason for magnetic interest at this time?
Yes, it is not really about the rotary. I'm trying to find out anything that regards to the magnetic field, especially one that is created by the forces of electricity. So that would be electromagnetism. But then, because we're dealing with the ferrite, and ferrite reacts in that way, and we have a certain amplification of the signal. If we could call it amplification, the Q factor, the mu, that creates, the mu of the area is one. The mu of the ferrite could be 800,000. Even though that most of the resources say that we've seen 20,000. So, I believe it's good to understand when somebody says ferrite and somebody says ferrite. And so it's here.
If you took QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
The ferromagnetic materials and the ferrimagnetic materials are very, very similar in outside performance. In other words, if you're dealing with these materials in a toroid or something like that, you're not going to see very, very big differences. The main differences between them are in the construction of oxide. The ferri materials typically have some kind of an oxygen molecule in oxidation or oxide, aluminum oxide, other things that mix in. It's just basically another procedure of forming a ferromagnetic material. So where the ferromagnetics are more, they're typically more iron-based. So it's really just the construction. But in other words, if you pick two toroids up from the bench, and one was made by like a company like CSC, Changsung, and they use their aluminum oxide as opposed to using, say, like an MPP core, you'd find out, because one's got nickel inside of it, they're going to have very, very similar performances. You can have the same mu's, same half lengths and everything, but typically the oxide materials are much less lower. They're cheaper materials, and they don't last as long as the nickel-based materials. Back over to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
I have a little problem with that, because maybe I didn't understand. Probably I would like Glenn to just answer that. Most of the natural magnetic oxides or magnetic materials, there are the materials that come to the group called ferri magnetic or ferri magnetic, and if Glenn could tell us what is the proper pronunciation for that.
Now, what's the advantage, Glenn, with the aluminum, for instance, the ferri materials, and when you say the ferro materials don't last as long, What's the method of failure when they don't last as long? How would you, Glenn?
It's the opposite. The ferry materials are dioxide materials. In which they have molecules of oxygen inside of them, and they're typically less expensive materials. The ferrous materials are your ones that which are stronger in iron, and their typical mixes are mixes of like nickel, nickel and iron mixtures, and they're very expensive because of the nickel content in them. And these are typically materials used to make conductors that handle DC bias on them. So in other words, when you start getting into the oxides, the MPP cores, all of these ferro and ferrimagnetic materials, you're talking about inductive cores that are able to hold DC bias. The ones with the oxides are the less expensive. So those are FERRI, the ferrimagnetics. Those are, you know, they're oxides with oxygen in them. They're cheaper, less expensive. The ones with the nickel iron are usually the better magnetics. They handle their temperature better, but they're much more expensive. So I hope that explains that one. Back to you, Dave.
So, magnetite, is magnetite ferro or ferrite?
That's a ferrimagnetic, F-E-R-R-I.
Okay.
Has oxygen. The key is oxygen or oxides, Leslie. That's the ferry, the oxides, oxygen.
Come on.
Why does adding the oxide make it cheaper? And what is the mechanism of failure?
Well, it's not so much a mechanism of failure per se. It's that how can I say? In other words, if you look at flux intensity, the performance of the core, you can have let's say a fixed permeability and so much DC bias, but the closer you run something to its maximum flux density, how sharp does the inductance roll off? If you want something with a very, very that will hold a very, very square loop with a very, very high DC bias on it, the nickels perform a little bit better. And as they heat up in temperature, they tend to hold their DC bias and high inductance better than the oxides, if that makes more sense to me.
A little bit. The really strong magnet, the NIBs.
This is not magnet.
Good point. So, a magnet, in the case of a neodymium iron boron. Are you saying that's a different kind of material, except that is that a ferri or a ferro? Over to you, Glenn.
Most of the magnetized materials fall into the ferromagnetic type. Now, I'm not saying that that's exclusive, but the majority fall into ferro, meaning that their iron content is much higher in those particular materials, and they can sustain their own magnetic fields, you know, as we're familiar with fixed magnets.
Is neodymium iron boron the top of the line right now, or if money is no object and I'm willing to use the rare earth materials, the really expensive one, is there an even stronger permanent magnet that you know of? Over you, Glenn.
There's always something that can be formulated probably a little bit more powerful. I know that the ones that are usually the most expensive and where you get the biggest bang for your buck are where, in other words, if you're looking for really, really strong magnets, I'm going to give you the materials that, and depending on how they're mixed, are going to have different responses. But here's the materials you want really, really strong magnets. Iron, nickel, cobalt, any of those three combinations are usually going to be your strongest mixes. There's some other materials, but basically iron, nickel, cobalt is going to give you some of the best performance for the buck.
I am a little bit confused with that. I understand that those are ferromagnetic, but then ferrimagnetic are being used for the microwave signals to be polarized in the same direction, and why then the microwaves are so much attracted to the ferrite magnetism that they are being used in isolated circularizers and gyrotours? I don't know what is that.
Thank you.